What we're watching or reading on the news isn't a series of isolated crises, but rather a widening conflict between two competing systems of governance and political economy. Hey everybody, this is Tiffany Georgopoulos here, and if you've been watching the news lately, it probably feels like the world is moving in a dozen unrelated directions at once. Because one day it's about Greenland and Arctic positioning, the next it's Venezuela making headlines, then Iran, then energy choke points in the Middle East, and so on. It can feel wildly disconnected. Like you wake up in the middle of the night and you start scrolling the headlines, and suddenly the world has shifted again while you were sleeping, and you find yourself asking, what on earth is going on? But what if the reason it feels chaotic isn't because the world is unraveling, but because we're only seeing surface level events without taking a step back to understand the deeper structure underneath them? Lucky for you, there's a framework that I think is incredibly useful right now to help you understand what is actually going on and how every headline you see in the news may be connected to one another, especially if you care about commodities, geopolitics, or the direction of capital flows. And this idea is that what we're watching or reading on the news isn't a series of isolated crises, but rather a widening conflict between two competing systems of governance and political economy. Not nation versus nation in a traditional sense, but system versus system. And once you start viewing headlines through that lens, events that seemed disconnected before begin to align in a much more coherent way. On one side, you have a model of power that's based on producing and controlling real physical things, like energy, metals, food, manufacturing, etc. And in that view, a country is strong if it can function on its own. And that's if it doesn't rely on other nations for critical supplies. On the other side, you have a model of power that's based less on what you physically produce and more on controlling the financial system. If global trade runs through your currency, if money flows through your banks, if countries depend on your financial networks, that's all power too. It's just financial power instead of industrial power. So you may be asking now, okay, so how do these two sides correlate to one another? Well, for a long time, these two systems actually worked together. Countries made different parts of the global economy run. For example, one country produced the energy, another mined the metals, while another assembled the final product, and the financial system connected all of it. Money moved easily across borders, trade was predictable, and supply chains stretched around the world because most governments believed those connections would stay open. And in that environment, it didn't matter as much where something was produced, because access felt secure. If you needed oil, you could import it. If you needed rare earth metals, you could source them. If you needed financing, global banks were there. And the assumption was that the system would continue to function, but that assumption has started to weaken. Because when countries begin to restrict trade, impose sanctions, or use financial systems as leverage, dependence starts to feel less like efficiency and more like vulnerability. Think about it. If your economy relies on another country for critical materials and that relationship turns political, suddenly you got a problem on your hands. And when dependence starts to feel dangerous, control over physical resources becomes much more important. And once control becomes a priority, you start asking a pretty simple question. What does a country actually need to function on its own? It needs energy, metals, food, and the materials that keep factories running and infrastructure operating. Because you can't reindustrialize without copper, you can't secure energy future without oil, gas, uranium, or coal, you can't build data centers, electrify transportation, or scale artificial intelligence without massive physical inputs. Even agriculture depends on fertilizer that ultimately traces back to mining and energy production. So what I'm getting at here is no matter how digital the economy becomes, it's still runs on physical foundations, and in my view, those foundations matter more today than they have in decades. And why do I think this? Let's go back to what we've been seeing in the headlines. Like, why has Greenland suddenly become strategically relevant? On the surface, it can sound strange because why would the United States be so interested in Greenland? But when you examine what Greenland represents, it starts to make so much more sense. Because Greenland has large amounts of valuable minerals that haven't been fully developed yet, like rare earth elements and uranium. These materials are essential for modern technology, like advanced electronics and renewable energy systems to military equipment and defense systems. In other words, they're not optional materials, they're critical. Greenland is also located in a very strategic part of the world. As Arctic ice slowly melts, new shipping routes are opening up across the top of the globe. Those routes can make trade between North America, Europe, and Asia faster and more efficient. They could also change military positioning and global trade patterns over time. So Greenland isn't about symbolism, it's about control. Control of minerals, control of logistics, and control of positioning in a world where supply chains are increasingly strategic. And the same way we can use that lens to understand why Greenland matters, it also helps explain Venezuela. Venezuela sits on some of the largest oil reserves in the world. Yet over the past decade, its economy has experienced one of the most severe collapses in modern history. And there were many causes behind that decline. Years of economic mismanagement and political instability weakened the country internally. And furthermore, sanctions later made it far more difficult for Venezuela to operate within the global financial system. But isolation did not remove Venezuela from the global energy map. Instead, it changed how the country operated. As access to Western banks and dollar-based systems narrowed, Venezuela strengthened relationships with countries that were facing similar restrictions, like Iran, Russia, and China. And in that environment, oil was no longer just a source of revenue. It became a tool, and it became a way to maintain trade, to build alliances, and to keep influence when traditional financial channels were harder to access. Because when a country is cut off from major financial networks, it doesn't just disappear from the global economy, it adapts. Trade doesn't just stop, it reroutes. Payments don't vanish, they change form. Instead of relying on banks and traditional settlement systems, countries lean more heavily on what they physically control. Oil gets shipped through alternative channels, commodities are exchanged directly, resources themselves become currency. So when financial access narrows, the physical asset is what carries the weight. And this isn't just unique to Venezuela. Anywhere political pressure increases and financial restrictions tighten, energy and raw materials start doing more than powering economies. They start shaping alliances, redefining trade routes, and are quietly shifting influence beneath the surface of everyday life. And that same dynamic becomes much clearer when you look at a place like the Strait of Hormuz. Hormuz is a narrow waterway that connects the Persian Gulf to the Gulf of Oman, and it functions as one of the most critical choke points in the global energy system. And the reason is simple. An extraordinary share of the world's oil supply must pass through it. Roughly one-fifth of the global oil consumption, which is about 20 million barrels per day, moves through that corridor. That's not just extra supply, it's a major pipeline for the world's oil. So if that passage were blocked or threatened, markets wouldn't wait and we'd see prices move fast. We're talking about a large jump, because when that much of the world's oil flows through one narrow passage and that passage is suddenly at risk, prices can move fast. In a worst case situation, you could see oil push into triple digits pretty quickly, and not because people are panicking, but because supply suddenly feels uncertain. And the reason that kind of repricing matters is because despite all the talk about renewables and electrification, modern economies still run on oil. Oil's deeply woven into how the global economy functions because it fuels transportation, supports manufacturing, powers agriculture, and keeps supply chains moving. So when tensions rise near a place like Hormuz, it isn't just another geopolitical headline. It touches the core systems that move goods, power industries, and connect economies. And once you see that, you start to notice something else. Many of today's geopolitical tensions aren't happening randomly. They tend to show up near major energy routes, key mineral deposits, or important shipping lanes. Whether it's the Arctic, the Persian Gulf, Eastern Europe, or the South China Sea, the common denominator here is that these are all places where resources, trade, and strategy overlap. Geography, in other words, matters again. And although oil is the most obvious example of this, it's not the only one, because copper, in many ways, may be an even more important part of this story. Unlike oil, copper doesn't usually make the front page headlines, but it's everywhere. It runs through power grids, it connects renewable energy systems, it's inside electric vehicles, data centers, military equipment, and the wiring that supports AI infrastructure. That doesn't matter though. What I'm getting at here is that if you're electrifying anything, you're using copper. The challenge is that while demand keeps growing, supply hasn't kept pace. Over the past few decades, we haven't seen many large, world-class copper discoveries. The copper that is being mined often comes from lower-grade deposits than in the past, which means more rock has to be processed to produce the same amount of metal. On top of that, it could take 10 to 15 years to move a major copper project from discovery to actual production. So, between environmental permitting, financing, construction, and infrastructure, this is not something that can be rushed. So even if demand suddenly accelerates because of electrification policies, grid expansion, or geopolitical shifts, supply can't just appear overnight. And that timing mismatch matters because when governments start prioritizing domestic manufacturing or energy independence, they don't just need ambition. They need materials. And in a world that is becoming more sovereignty focused, critical minerals like copper stop becoming background commodities. They become strategic. And energy tells a similar story. Some of the world's major oil-producing regions are no longer expanding the way they once did. The North Sea, which was one of the most important oil hubs in the world for decades, has seen production decline from its peak in the early 2000s. Prudhoe Bay in Alaska, once one of the largest oil discoveries in North America, is also well past its highest output levels. That doesn't mean oil disappears. It means many of the easiest, most productive fields have already been developed. New supply still comes online, but it often comes from projects that are more complex, more expensive, or technically more challenging than the giant fields discovered in earlier decades. At the same time, global demand hasn't vanished. Oil still fuels transportation, shipping, aviation, agriculture, and heavy industries. So when supply growth slows and demand remains steady, the system becomes more sensitive and smaller disruptions can have larger price effects. Over time, that shifts the mindset governments have because energy isn't just about getting the lowest price anymore. It becomes about stability, security, and not being overly reliant on someone else to keep your economy running. And when energy and critical materials start being viewed through that lens, another question naturally follows. If physical resources are becoming more strategic, what happens to the financial system that sits on top of them? And that's where gold starts to enter the conversation. Gold isn't just another commodity like oil or copper. It plays a different role. Like oil is used for energy, copper is used for electrification, gold, on the other hand, is primarily used as money, or more specifically, a store of value. What makes gold different is that it doesn't depend on somebody else's promises. For example, a stock depends on a company, a bond depends on a government paying you back. I mean, even money sitting in a bank depends on the banking system functioning. But gold doesn't rely on any of that. It simply exists. It's not somebody else's liability. In recent years, central banks, especially those outside of the traditional Western financial system, have been increasing their gold reserves. And that doesn't just happen randomly. Central banks hold gold to diversify away from reliance on any single currency or financial system. Like when sanctions increase and financial infrastructure becomes more politicized, holding an asset that sits outside that system becomes more attractive. Gold doesn't react the same way oil or copper does. It doesn't spike because of a pipeline disruption or surge because of infrastructure demand. Instead, it tends to move when trust in the financial system shifts. It reflects confidence or uncertainty in currencies and institutions. And that matters because modern finance runs on access and promises. Gold doesn't. That distinction becomes especially important when access to the financial system itself can be limited. Modern finance is layered. It's built on contracts like futures, derivatives, ETFs, credit instruments. These tools allow capital to move quickly and efficiently, and they create liquidity. But they also rely on continued access and trust. Physical resources, on the other hand, don't operate on those terms. Because think about it, it takes years to build a mine, oil fields decline gradually, agricultural output depends on seasons and weather, and the physical world moves on long timelines. For long stretches, financial assets can outperform because capital flows freely and leverage expands. Paper claims can grow much faster than physical production. But when supply tightens or when geopolitical friction restricts access to the financial system, those underlying physical constraints start to matter more. And one of the clearest ways to see that dynamic play out is through sanctions. When a country like Iran gets cut off from the global dollar settlement system, the effects are almost immediate and very real for everyday people. The currency weakens, which makes everything imported more expensive. Prices rise, inflation accelerates, and suddenly, people have less purchasing power. That puts pressure on households and on governments. And out of necessity, those countries start finding alternative ways to keep trade flowing. They build networks that don't rely on the dominant financial infrastructure. Like, they trade commodities directly, they make deals in non-dollar currencies, and they find creative workarounds, like shipping oil on vessels that operate outside normal tracking systems. Sometimes, gold becomes a part of that picture too. It not be as anyone is trying to make a political statement, but because it is one of the few assets that sits outside the traditional financial system and still has universally recognized value. What this shows is that when access to the financial system tightens, countries fall back on what they physically control. And when you zoom out, that has way broader implications. Because if countries begin trusting each other less, relying less on global trade, and caring more about controlling their own energy and materials, markets eventually adjust to that reality. Money tends to flow toward what governments and institutions decide is essential. And right now, what's becoming essential again is control over physical resources. That doesn't mean prices move in straight lines or that every company tied to commodities succeeds. It simply means that when the structure of the global system shifts, capital tends to follow that shift over time. So what we're really talking about here is a gradual rebalancing between financial power and physical production. Because if countries begin prioritizing their own energy, securing critical materials, and reducing dependence on external supply chains, then resources like oil, copper, uranium, rare earths, and even gold naturally become more important. And when something becomes more important at the national level, it eventually becomes more important in the markets as well. So when you take a step back and connect the dots of everything that we've covered, it becomes clear that these topics aren't just separate stories, but that they're all part of the same structural shift. And that's really what this video has been about. It's not a prediction of collapse or dramatic warning. It's about understanding the growing tension between two systems. One that's built primarily on financial integration and one grounded in control over physical resources. And if that balance between finance and physical production is being reworked, then paying attention to real-world resources starts to matter way more. That's where our focus comes in, because at Natural Resource Stocks, our goal is to simply understand that shift and find out what's going on. We look beneath the headlines to the structural forces driving them, because those forces usually tend to shape the long-term outcomes more than daily news cycles ever can. And if the foundation of the system is shifting, then understanding natural resources helps you understand where things are headed. For Natural Resource Stocks, I'm Tiffany Georgopoulos, and I'll see you next time. All right, guys, thank you so much for watching. And if you enjoyed this video, please hit that like button down below. And if you want to learn more about natural resources, junior mining companies, or geopolitics and more, hit that subscribe button. And I promise you, you will stay updated. We also have an Instagram and TikTok now, along with our other social medias that will all be linked in the bio if you want to check it out. Bye, y'all.